I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is a special edition of Cape Up. The nation is engulfed in a misguided and misinformed debate about critical race theory, a concept that's only been taught in law schools. And yet, local school districts are racing to ban it from being taught to children. But let's be honest, what they're really doing is blocking a more honest teaching of America's painful history as a reaction against the 1619 Project. Brian Stevenson, the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, has been trying to engage us in that more honest historical reflection for years. The most visible expression of that effort is the Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, aka the Lynching Memorial, in Montgomery, Alabama. This conversation with Stevenson is from 2018, but the ground we cover remains timeless. Listen to him explain why we must come to terms with our history if we're ever to start healing right now. Brian Stevenson, thank you very much for being on the podcast and for having us down here in your offices at the Equal Justice Initiative here in Montgomery, Alabama.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So before we get to the reason why we're actually down here, I want you to define a term that you see when you go to the Legacy Museum, when you go to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, and that is racial terror lynchings. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. So what we're talking about are lynchings that were designed to terrorize people based on their race. In, I think, popular culture, we have a notion that lynchings were what happened when someone was hanged. And of course, lots of lynching victims weren't actually hanged. They were drowned, they were beaten to death, they were shot, they were burned alive. And so when we talk about lynchings, we're talking about a category of crime committed by groups of people. And racial terror lynchings are murders, crimes committed by groups of people of African Americans to terrorize the African American community. There was mob violence, there was frontier justice in many parts of this country where there was no functioning criminal justice system. If someone did something violent or broke the law, a group might come together to exercise punishment against that person. And in that respect, you would see white people hanged. You'd see other kinds of people hanged. But they weren't trying to terrorize the community. It was typically for a well-known violent crime around which there was some group consciousness that someone had to be punished. Black people were typically lynched in communities where there was a functioning criminal justice system. There was no need for frontier justice. And in fact, hundreds were pulled out of jails and courthouses to be lynched. And these lynchings were violence directed not just at that individual, but at the entire African American community. Black people were lynched for things like walking too close to a white woman, for asking for better wages, for preaching equality. And these violations, these social transgressions, would be something that could get African Americans lynched, and that wasn't true for anyone else. So when we talk about racial terror lynchings, we're talking about the racialized violence that was directed at the directed at African Americans following emancipation to reinforce racial hierarchy, to reinforce white supremacy. They were designed to terrorize. These bodies would sometimes, the battered bodies would be dragged through black communities.
And I was gonna ask you about that, because it wasn't hanging the person wasn't enough.
That's right.
They were after hanged, shot, some burned, and as you were about to say, dragged through the streets, and particularly through black communities.
Yes, it was really quite graphic. It was quite torturous, and sometimes people would be castrated or their fingers would be cut off, and this violent, torturous mutilation of the body, shooting the corpse 1,000 times, cutting off parts of the body, selling these parts as souvenirs, posing with the body as if there was something to celebrate in this barbarity. Sometimes someone would be positioned near the hanging body, and would not allow the black family or black church or black community to come and claim their loved one. They would insist that it hang there for 3 or 4 days to terrorize more people. There are accounts of lynchers tying the body to a vehicle and driving through the black part of town, and if black people went inside and closed their doors, they'd actually force people out of their homes to see these corpses dragged through the streets. And in that sense, it was terrorism. I think when people characterize the violence that we're talking about as a murder or even as a hate crime, they're not adequately appreciating the scale of it.
Yeah, and even after your description just now, hate crime seems incredibly puny,
yes,
compared to what you've just described.
Well, that's and it's the reason why in this country after 9/11 we didn't say the people who perpetrated that act were criminals. We don't treat them like criminals. We said they were terrorists. They don't have the rights that people accused of crimes have. They've been held in spaces. The courts have not given them the same protections. And we don't typically go to war in response to crime. We have gone to war in response to terror. And no one thinks that the perpetrators of that horrific act were just trying to kill the people working in the World Trade Towers. This was designed to terrorize our nation, to cause all of us to feel fear and insecurity. And that's what terrorism does, and that's exactly what was happening to African Americans from the end of Reconstruction until the 1950s. And it's why this kind of violence requires particular attention.
In talking about terror and terrorism and the fact that you had people watching these lynchings, in some cases up to or more than 10,000 people. We've seen pictures of people posing, smiling underneath a lynched person. Where's the accountability for those people who are in those photos, who watched what happened? Is there any way to hold them accountable, even in some moral sense?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really important question. I mean, I think, Jonathan, you've gotten to the heart of why we're trying to do what we do. You cannot engage, participate, look the other way in the face of this kind of spectacle violence and go unharmed, go unchanged. You know, white families would bring their small children and they would lift them up so they could get a better view of this human being being burned to death, this human being being tortured, this human being being mutilated. And the psychic trauma, the scarring, the injury that does to a normal, healthy human being can't really be measured. And when we don't express that this is wrong, and when we don't hold people accountable, what we do is we create a relationship to these black people that suggests that their victimization is not the same as the victimization of other people. When you hurt black people, when you batter black people, when you beat black people, it's not a crime, it's not bad, it's not even immoral. And that consciousness is, I think, at the heart of what is so troubling about our silence about this history. You know, I make the point often that the people who perpetrated these racial terror lynchings weren't the Ku Klux Klan. They didn't cover their faces. This wasn't done in the middle of the night. They could have buried the bodies underground to mask this violence. But instead, they did the opposite. They lifted these bodies up. They invited the whole community to come and participate. They sometimes served lemonade and deviled eggs as refreshments while this torture was taking place. And they acculturated communities into accepting this kind of brutality against black people. And the legacy of that, I think, is quite tragic. So accountability, for me, is at the heart of what we're trying to do. We can't go on. We cannot pretend that something really destructive, something really corruptive happened when communities came to celebrate this kind of violence. So we have to talk about it. We have to acknowledge the wrongfulness of it. I think we would benefit as a society if we expressed our shame about it, and everybody was complicit. Not just the people who literally showed up and hanged the person or shot the person or drowned the person. It was all the elected officials who stood out of the way. It was the federal government who did not intervene despite hundreds and hundreds of requests that there be some kind of intervention. It was law enforcement. And the tragedy of that terror, which is still felt in communities today, you know, older people of color come up to me sometimes and they say, Mr. Stevenson, I get angry when I hear somebody on TV talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. They said, we grew up with terror. We had to worry about being bombed and lynched and menaced every day of our lives. And it actually provokes them that our nation is capable of fighting a war on terror, sending troops and spending billions to confront the threat posed by terror when our nation did nothing, while millions of people, African-American people, were being terrorized and traumatized by this violence, where they were sending away their loved ones because they couldn't feel safe and secure. And so accountability is at the heart of this. How do we recover from something so brutal, so tragic, so devastating as the legacy, as the evidence of brutal violence that is presented by these lynchings?
Mm-hmm. You know, a dear friend of mine, Joe McClain, who is deeply involved in Democratic politics, when nooses were found at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, he sent in an op-ed piece, sent it to me, and said, what do you think of this? It was one of the most powerful pieces I had ever read by a white Southerner. And the headline was, "Hey boy, want to go see a hanging?" It was his grandfather said that to his father when his father was a child, and they went to see this lynching. Fast forward, they know the name of the person who was lynched. They got together relatively recently to memorialize his lynching. Mm. And Joe said something interesting, and it gets to your thing about accountability, and that was, and no one really talked about it, but he believes that the reason why his father and he are so committed to Democratic Party politics and to electing people who do the right thing was just sort of the implicit lesson learned from bearing witness to something so barbaric.
Yeah. Well, I think that exposing a family or exposing a community or exposing a county to this kind of violence is going to create real injury. There is no justification for burning someone alive, hanging someone, brutalizing someone in this way. And I do think there is a kind of scarring that takes place. And that's why I really continue to believe that none of us is free in this country. We're all burdened by our history of racial inequality. It's created a kind of smog that we all breathe in, and it has prevented us from being healthy. And when we put out a report on lynching in 2015, we got hundreds of letters and emails and calls from African Americans whose family members had been lynched, and they desperately wanted to talk about it. And we sort of expected that. It was much more than we expected. What we didn't expect were the hundreds of calls and letters we got from white Southerners who talked about family members who would brag about having been involved in a lynching. White Southerners who remembered being taken as children to the sites of this brutality and how it's haunted them. And we are all haunted by this history. We've just practiced silence so long. No one has been willing to speak. And as long as we pretend, you know, for me, what's analogous is something like child abuse and sex abuse. For decades, children in this country who were sexually abused were encouraged to not talk about it. And they had to bear the trauma and the grief and the burden of that abuse by themselves. And it often left them vulnerable to doing things that were destructive themselves. And what we've learned about abuse and how to help people recover is that we've got to create safe spaces for people to talk about it so that people can hear, you did nothing wrong. You're not responsible for that. I look at domestic violence. 50 years ago, we didn't deal with domestic violence very thoughtfully. If a woman complained about being abused by her husband, there was no likelihood in many communities that that man was going to be arrested. We just didn't think it was a big deal. Our attitude was, well, if you chose to get into a relationship with someone who abuses you, shame on you. That's your fault. And police would show up. We wouldn't make these arrests. But then we started listening to the voices of abused women, and our consciousness changed. And today, even our private, even our star athletes, if they are accused of domestic violence, they're going to face consequences that they would not have faced 10 years ago. And this consciousness raising, this narrative shifting, is key to an increased shamefulness, awareness about child abuse and sex abuse and domestic violence. And we haven't done that when it comes to the history of racial inequality. In fact, we've done the opposite. We've actually created a false narrative about how wonderful and glorious this stuff was.
Right. Talking about the white people you've heard from who, you know, are haunted mm-hmm. by these things, one of the things I just want to put out there is that in addition to people posing for pictures, they sent postcards.
Yes.
And you talked about earlier about how, you know, the bodies would be cut up. People would save pieces
yes.
of the victims
yes.
as mementos.
Yes.
This yeah. was macabre,
absolutely.
Brutal.
Absolutely. Well, black people were thought of as game. I mean, that commodification of African Americans that takes place during slavery. You're not human. You're something else. The slave catalog that we have in our museum on display, the title of it is what shakes me. It says, Negroes, Mules, Carts, Feed. And there is this inability to see the humanity of people because of their color. And posing with these battered bodies was like posing with the big fish you caught, the game you slaughtered, and carving up part of that as a totem of your accomplishment, your achievement. In taking the life of a black person, just speaks to this horrific bigotry, this horrific disease that has so infected our nation. And it's why I think it's necessary for there to be treatment. A lot of people have assumed that somehow this stuff is just going to evaporate. It'll go away. With enough black achievement, all of these things will dissipate. It doesn't work
like a black president.
Like a black president. But it doesn't work that way. It's a disease, and we're not going to get healthy. We're not going to get well until we treat it. And you can't treat it by ignoring it. You can't treat it with silence. You've got to talk about it. You've got to confront it. You've got to acknowledge it. And something transformational has to happen. But that won't happen while we pretend this wasn't a big deal.
One of the things, now that I think of it, you know, we sort of pretend that the reason why African Americans moved en masse from the South to the North was because, well, the slaves were freed, and so then African Americans decided we don't have to be on the plantations anymore, so we're just going to move north, and that is not why?
No, it is absolutely not. 90% of the African American population at the beginning of the 20th century lived in the Deep South. What they knew was agriculture. What they knew were the skills and trades that are associated with an agrarian economy. So this region offered them the best opportunity to develop and take the skills they had developed during enslavement and turn them into jobs and to ways to support their families. They were holding on to that, and then the terror started, then the threats started, then they were disenfranchised, then they were marginalized, and then they were menaced. And it was only after being threatened and menaced and terrorized that black people fled. And they went to Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Oakland, not as immigrants seeking new economic opportunities, but they went there as refugees and exiles from terror. And in the international context, we realize now that when we're dealing with a refugee population, as opposed to just an immigrant population, there are special needs that have to be addressed. But we didn't do that in the urban North and West. We actually segregated people into ghettos, and we denied them opportunities that other people got. And this movement from the South to the North didn't actually create freedom. It just created a little bit more security. And the tragedy of that migration, that exodus, if you will, is that families were separated. The opportunity to create wealth was lost. The skills that had been developed for generations were no longer relevant, useful in the urban North and West. And we devastated the ability of African Americans in this country to do what other immigrant populations had done, which is to work hard and acquire wealth. Black people worked hard and they were lynched for it. They worked hard and they were forced to leave for it. They worked hard and they were disenfranchised and humiliated for it. And that story hasn't been told, and the consequence of that bigotry hasn't been acknowledged. And in fact, what we do is say, oh, no, Black people, they don't work that hard. They're not this, they're not that. We continue to develop these narratives about some deficit in the African-American community. When you think about it, when you really think about it, how enslaved Black people got their emancipation and chose to work with those who had enslaved them, chose to find a way to do business, chose to find a way to forgive their enslavers, to live in peace and harmony. And despite that heroic choice, were mistreated for it, were disenfranchised for it, and then they were terrorized for it. And even in the midst of terror and lynching, Black people weren't calling for vengeance. They weren't calling for violence and revenge. They were just calling for peace and security. And during this period of civil rights, you know, we're here in Montgomery, Alabama, I think about it more and more, the incredible courage, because when you understand the legacy of lynching and the violence that people face, you have to think differently about what Claudette Colvin did on the Montgomery bus, what Rosa Parks did on the Montgomery bus. By resisting segregation, they were risking their lives. They were saying, I'm prepared to die for freedom. And we haven't acknowledged that. And while they fought for freedom, freedom that should have been given to them at the very moment they entered this country, they were saying, but we're not going to do anything violent. We still love you. We still care about this country. And it saddens me that African Americans, when they express their pain, when they protest about police violence, when they question inequality, when they raise issues of bondage and discrimination, African Americans are seen as not patriotic. I can't identify a race of people in this country who are more committed to the health of this country, who believe more in the Constitution, who believe more in equality and liberation and fairness to everyone else than Black people. Because despite the brutality, despite the hate, despite the violence, we keep saying, let's find a way to move forward. And it's a remarkable story of a community of people who desperately just want peace. They understand, however, that peace is not the absence of tension. What African Americans understand is that peace isn't the absence of tension, it's the presence of justice. And we have denied Black people justice for centuries. And that's what all of us, many of us, are saying. We just need to get to that justice thing for real.
Well, let's talk about the museum and the memorial. And in, I believe it was the 60 Minutes interview, you were talking about African Americans, and I think this quote sort of weaves perfectly into the museum and the memorial, where you said that they were promised freedom after emancipation, but what they got was terror and lynching. They were promised security, and what they got was segregation and apartheid and humiliation. And then they were promised equality, and what they got was mass incarceration. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
I think I almost got it.
Yeah.
Got it down. In the Legacy Museum here in Montgomery, you weave that story, that history. Talk about the museum.
Yeah, I mean, I just think we haven't created narrative museums. This is intended to be a narrative museum. I went to Johannesburg to the Apartheid Museum, and it was one of the first narrative museums I'd ever been to because it tells the story of apartheid. And it's a challenging cultural experience. When you buy your tickets, you get assigned a ticket that either says white or colored, and you're required to go through the door that your ticket permits. And I went with three Scandinavian white human rights activists, and we all got tickets that said white, and they didn't want to go through the white door. They felt ashamed to kind of participate in that. So they went back to this Black South African woman working and said, oh, and they said, well, we want a different ticket. We want a colored ticket. And she said, no, it doesn't work like that. You take that ticket and you go into the Apartheid Museum, or you can go back where you came from and you can tell people you were unwilling to confront the legacy of apartheid. And then she kind of slammed her door. It was powerful.
Wow.
And you know, that discomforting begins even before you step inside. And there are spaces in that museum where you see the nooses hanging. And I began to think about how in this country, we don't have museums like that. We don't tell the story. And I've been to the Holocaust Museum here in America, and it's a powerful institution. And when I go through that museum at the end of it, I am motivated to say, never again. And then I realize that we haven't created spaces in this country that tell the history of racial inequality, of slavery, of lynching, of segregation, that motivate people to say never again. And because we've never made that commitment, we keep replicating and institutionalizing and introducing new forms of bigotry and discrimination. So our vision for the museum was to kind of create that narrative museum, to tell the story of slavery, to make it human. That's the other thing. Most people don't actually have a visual of slavery that upsets them. They don't have an optic about people who are enslaved that exposes the brutality of it. If we have any optics at all, if we have any pictures at all, they're tranquil. We dress enslaved people up. We make it seem as if they're happy. People actually debate whether black people were better off during slavery.
Still.
Michelle Obama gave a talk at the Democratic National Convention. She talked about living in a house built by slaves, just as an historical reference. She was attacked for it. And that phenomenon is a consequence of our cultural complicity and not educating people about the brutality of it. So when you come into our museum, we want folks to see the human figure in chains. We want them to encounter the bondage and read the first-person narratives. It's a first-person voice museum. We put on the walls and on the banners the voices of enslaved people, the slave narrative texts, which we really spent a lot of time with, which are incredibly rich. They're beautifully written. These are enslaved people who get freedom and then write about their experience. And they were really incredibly powerful. But those texts create a very different picture of what slavery is. And you hear from women, one of my favorite quotes from one of the slave narratives, this woman who was enslaved says, "Selling is worse than flogging." She said, "I've been beaten many times and my back is always healed. They took my husband away and my heart is not right yet." And this consciousness about the trauma of separation, you know, and we create a warehouse, we replicate the slave pens that you could find in Montgomery. And we tell people that you're standing on the site of a former warehouse where people were enslaved. And when you go into that part of the museum and you see those pens, I think a lot of people think, oh, they've replicated slave pens. Isn't that interesting? But as you approach and you get closer, that's when the ghosts of enslaved people emerge. And they begin to tell their stories. And we use those holograms to present visitors with the stories of tragedy, of loss. And we have these amazing performers in one of the pens singing. And, you know, those Negro spirituals that sometimes you hear, you know, high school choirs in the Midwest singing joyfully just have a different resonance. When you hear somebody singing, "Lord, how come me here," but they're in a pen with chains on, it has a different resonance. When someone sings, "This may be the last time," because they're worried if they'll ever see their children again, it has a different resonance. And we want to create that relationship to the suffering. And it's challenging, but it's necessary. And when people come out of that part of the exhibit, we present them with the slave catalogs and the slave narratives and the iconography, the slave auction posters, which you would see everywhere, and the fugitive slave rewards being posted. And then last but not least, the heartbreaking ads that emancipated black people put in the newspaper when emancipation come, desperately trying to find their children, trying to find their loved ones. And for me, it just kind of forces people to engage in a new kind of relationship with the institution of slavery. It's a discomforting one. It's a disruptive one, but a necessary one.
You know, there was one thing that I learned from the very first panel that I think a lot of people will be shocked to learn, that there is a distinction between the transatlantic slave trade and the domestic slave trade. In school, you're like, slavery, slavery, and it was over, and the Civil War came, because the Civil War came, and it's done. And that's not the case at all. The transatlantic slave trade ended when?
In 1808, Congress bans the transatlantic slave trade at the early part of the 19th century. And you're absolutely right, and your insight into that is so important. We prefer to talk about the transatlantic slave trade because that involved Africans, and that involved Europeans, and that involved other countries. Everybody was complicit. And somehow we think that insulates us from the shame that we would otherwise experience. But the Congress actually banned the transatlantic slave trade in 1808. It's the domestic slave trade that populated the American South. Most states in the American South weren't states in the 19th and the 18th century. Alabama didn't become a state until 1820. Mississippi didn't become a state until the 19th century. Louisiana, Arkansas, these places were relatively new states in the 19th century. They didn't have any enslaved people here. It's the domestic slave trade that brings a million enslaved people from the mid-Atlantic and north to the deep South. And enslaved people were transported first by land. They would be forced to walk 1,000 miles in chains. And then they were brought...
Were they arrested? Were they kidnapped? How was that possible?
They were sold. So as slavery begins to become less acceptable in the mid-Atlantic and the north, slave owners don't want to lose the investment they've made in their property.
Oh, right.
So they're desperately trying to sell them farther south. And they do, and they are paraded, marched down by foot. Then they're shipped down by boat, and enslaved people would come up the Alabama River to the dock a couple blocks from where we're sitting. And then in Montgomery becomes a very prominent slave trading space because of a rail line. The state used slave labor to build a rail line that connected Montgomery to Columbus and then to the Mid-Atlantic. It was one of the only Deep South communities that had a continuous rail line. And so then every day, hundreds of enslaved people would show up here. And that domestic slave trade is what created this mass transference of enslaved black people. And then what was also unique about America is that if you were black, you were born a slave. The plantation owner believed that he owned your infant children and could sell them and do with them whatever he chose to do. And the domestic slave trade is an important component of this story, because in many ways it was as barbaric, and perhaps in some ways more barbaric, because 50% of enslaved people were separated from their children, their loved ones, their parents, their siblings during the domestic slave trade. And that injury to the heart might have been more devastating than any injury that could be imposed.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Posed on the body.
The Legacy Museum takes you from slavery to lynching, to segregation, and then, I'm not going to say ends because the story continues, mass incarceration.
Yeah.
It's meant to show the line, the line from slavery all the way to mass incarceration. For the person who might be hearing this for the first time and thinking, oh, now come on, what does slavery have to do with mass incarceration? Explain it.
Yeah, well, I don't think the great evil of American slavery was involuntary servitude or forced labor. I really believe that the true evil of American slavery was the narrative of racial difference that we created to justify it. We said that black people are not people. They're not fully human. They're not evolved. The United States Supreme Court accepted that we're three-fifths human. And this ideology of white supremacy that we created to justify slavery, you know, slave owners didn't want to feel immoral. They didn't want to feel like they were doing something inhumane. So they said, no, these black people need to be slaves. We're helping them by enslaving them because they're not evolved. They're not moral. And that ideology of white supremacy for me was the true evil of American slavery. And if you read the 13th Amendment, which is passed in 1865, it talks about ending involuntary servitude and ending forced labor, but it doesn't say anything about ending this ideology of white supremacy. And because of that, I don't think slavery ends in 1865. I think it evolves. And that's the thesis you see in our museum. Slavery evolves into this era of lynching and terrorism. It's the reason why nobody cares that thousands of black people are being hanged and drowned and beaten and burned to death on the courthouse lawn while thousands cheer. Is because we have this ideology of white supremacy, we have this narrative of racial difference that victimization doesn't matter. And then it evolves into this period of Jim Crow and segregation. I mean, how could we have possibly believed it was sensible to say, you can't love that person because of the color of their skin. You can't play baseball with that person. You can't go to a social event with that person. You can't go to church with that person. We have statutes on our museum wall that talk about how even prisons were racially segregated. Even white felons and criminals had to be protected from the scourge of integration. And that consciousness can only be explained when you understand this continuing, persisting narrative of racial difference. And then we pass the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and we still don't end this narrative of racial difference. We still live today in a country where if you are black or brown, you are going to be presumed dangerous and guilty in certain situations. And it doesn't matter how kind you are, doesn't matter how hardworking you are, doesn't matter how talented you are. These two young men in a Starbucks in Philadelphia get arrested by the police simply because they are black. They're being presumed dangerous. And I'm a practicing lawyer for a long time. I go into court sometimes, I have my suit and tie on, I'll sit down at defense counsel's table, and I've had judges come out and say, hey, you get back out there in the hallway, you wait until your lawyer gets here. I don't want any defendant sitting in my courtroom without their lawyer. And I have to apologize. I have to say, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't introduce myself. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the lawyer. And then the judge will laugh, and the prosecutor will laugh, and I'll make myself laugh because I don't want to disadvantage my clients. And the burden of this presumption, which manifests itself in our criminal justice system, where people are wrongly accused or wrongly convicted or unfairly sentenced, is the reason why we can't talk about slavery, terrorism, segregation, without talking about mass incarceration, without talking about police violence, without talking about this contemporary presumption of dangerousness and guilt that continues to burden black and brown people. And we live in a country today where 1 in 3 black male babies is expected to go to jail or prison, and nobody cares. Nobody's talking about it. It's not a political issue. It's not a campaign issue. And it is the same indifference to a crisis impacting African-American communities that existed during the time of segregation, that existed during the time of lynching, that existed during the time of slavery. And if we don't wake up, if we don't challenge that indifference, there'll be new manifestations 50 years from now, 100 years from now. And part of the vision for me of this museum is I want to create a country where 100 years from now, black and brown people are not presumed dangerous and guilty, where we acknowledge this history, where we recover from it, where we don't want to celebrate the mid-19th century by talking about how glorious and romantic it is, by simply ignoring slavery, where we don't talk about how great our country has been without acknowledging this hardship, this brutality. And I just think we're not going to get there until we create spaces like this museum.
One of the things you've said is that one of the sort of evolutions is that lynching went underground.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so instead of the sort of public spectacle of putting black people to death for unbelievable things like the person we're looking to lynch isn't here, so we're going to lynch you and your brother, which is one of the things I saw at the memorial, which we'll talk about in a minute. Quickly talk about how lynching went underground.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's after World War II. It's in the 1930s where the optic of America fighting for freedom in Europe became really disingenuous. And it was actually Nazi Germany and the communists that began saying, well, how can you claim to be fighting for freedom and equality when you treat your black people this way? And these lynchings became just irrefutable evidence of a hypocritical America. And the federal government began saying to these state governments, you know, we got to do something about this lynching. It just looks bad. We're not saying it's immoral, but it just kind of looks bad. So what can we do? And what the South begins to do is to promise the mob that they will have their death. They will have their battered body. We just have to do it indoors. And so lynching moves out from outdoors to indoors. We have these sham trials that last a few hours. And then we hang the person. Then we execute the person. The death penalty is the stepchild of lynching. It's the same lethal violence. It's shrouded by the same kind of unreliability and racial bias. 87% of the people executed for the crime of rape between 1930 and 1972 were black people convicted of raping white women. It's the same narrative. And it goes inside where it's no more credible, no more just, no more fair, but it has the veneer of legality, of criminal justice. And that's the criminal justice system that we're still dealing with, because at no point have we repented for that corrupt criminal justice system, that perversion of criminal justice, that racist criminal justice. We haven't repented, we haven't acknowledged, we've just actually magnified it. We go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 to 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today. We've just expanded it. And that's why you cannot look at our country, which has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, which is the most punitive society on the planet, which has now created an environment where 70 million Americans have criminal arrests, and understand what we are doing and are silent about what we're doing without understanding this line from slavery to terrorism to segregation.
In the Legacy Museum, you have 320 jars.
Yeah.
Filled with dirt.
Yeah.
From the counties where documented lynchings have happened.
Yes.
That is a direct line to what's the shorthand is the lynching memorial, mm-hmm. but it really is the National Memorial for Peace and Justice.
Yeah.
Where did the idea come from for this memorial? And describe what people would see
sure.
when they go to it.
Well, when we did our slavery report, we decided to put up markers at the sites where the slave trade was most active here in Montgomery, because this is a city with 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy and not a word about slavery. And just getting people to kind of see the word slavery or enslavement was critical. And I was really moved by how energizing it was to African-Americans, to people in this community, and actually by a lot of others who just said, finally, we're acknowledging, we're telling the truth. And so we began to see the power of public monuments and public markers. We started a project to put markers at various lynching sites. And the difficulty is that with 4,000 spread out all over the country, it would take a really long time to achieve that. And that's when the idea of having a single location, a single space where we could memorialize all of these lynchings emerged. And that was the genesis of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. We had already started going to lynching sites, inviting community members to have them collect this soil. And the soil project really just grew out of a desire to give people something to do in the face of this grief, in the face of this trauma. And the first time we did, it was mostly African-Americans who came, and they went to lynching sites, and they collected soil. They put them in a jar with the name of the victim and the date of the lynching, and then they bring it back, and we ask them to make a reflection. And then the next time we do it, the group got more diverse. And now when we do these things, we'll have hundreds of people, black and white people, and they'll go to these sites, and they'll dig this soil, and it's tangible. And what I loved about soil is it's such a powerful medium, because in that soil is the sweat of the enslaved. In that soil is the blood of those who were lynched and terrorized, the tears of those who were humiliated and segregated. But also in that soil, we can grow something. We could actually plant something that becomes beautiful, that nurtures us, that sustains us. And that idea was part of the memorial as well. And so we decided to just create a place here in Montgomery that would become the National Memorial. And the naming these unnamed victims was a big part of it. Identifying the counties and the places where this violence took place was a big part of it. But we wanted to tell the whole story. So when you walk into our memorial, after you see that quote from Dr. King, you begin a path. And I was at the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, and I was struck by when you go there, there are no words. That a massive sculpture near Brandenburg Gate is just, it's very powerful.
It is. I've been there.
Yeah.
It is extremely powerful.
Yeah.
I'm actually now reminiscent.
Yes. You get in there. But what's interesting about that is people come with their own narratives about the Holocaust. They actually trust visitors to know enough about the Holocaust to have the kind of experience that is intended. We realized that we couldn't do that here. People don't have a narrative about racial terror lynchings. They don't actually understand that history. And so when you walk into our site, you walk along this path where we narrate the history. We talk about the domestic slave trade. We talk about, and you can't understand lynching until you understand slavery. And so the first thing you encounter is a sculpture, a slavery sculpture, that was made by a West African artist named Kwame Akoto Bamfo. It's such a powerful piece of art, and it's black people in chains. It's black people in anguish. It's black people in bondage. It's black people who are struggling to get free. But the other thing that he communicates is that he shows the bondage and the suffering and the struggle, but he also shows the strength and the humanity and the dignity and the capacity to endure. He calls it unchinchim, which is from an African proverb, and it means the capacity to endure, to overcome, the capacity to be resilient in the face of suffering and inequality. And when you see that, it sobers you, and you continue down that path, and then you make the turn, and that's when you see the memorial square, which contains 800 6-foot monuments. They're Corten steel. And we went through a lot of metals and a lot of options. And you know, some of the folks were presenting us things, oh, it should be pristine and beautiful. And we said, you know, it really shouldn't, because this is an ugly, painful, difficult history. And these Corten steel monuments, when they arrive, they're silver. And they oxidize when it rains. They actually begin to change color, and they all become this array of brown and red and dark, and it looks like the African American community. And we engrave the names of victims. Every county where lynching took place is identified. And when you walk through, they're at eye level. You have an intimate relationship with these monuments.
And they never touch the ground.
Yes, exactly. That's right. They never touch the ground. Even at that first level, they're up a few inches.
And is that's to mimic the being hanged?
That's right. And the sense of it just intensifies. So you finish the first corridor, and then you get into the second quarter where the floor begins to slope downward and the monuments begin to rise. And as you get to the end of that corridor and you turn the third quarter, you realize now that you're standing under hundreds of these figures, and that violence and that terror and that trauma has been lifted above you. You're under it. It shadows you. You can't escape it. And I think some people thought, when I was going through corridor one, I'll be happy to get just kind of a little more distance between these things where I don't have to touch them. But when you get into these other quarters, when they're just above you, I think for most people it's even more ominous. And we introduce in that corridor the stories. We want people to understand why or how these tragedies happened. And they're heartbreaking. You know, Mary Turner complained about her husband being lynched, and they came back and they lynched her too. People were lynched because their son-in-law wasn't present, some family member wasn't present. And all of that violence is difficult but necessary to absorb. And when we get down to the end of that quarter, we say something. We felt like we had to say something. And we dedicate this space for the hanged and the drowned and the beaten. But then we talk about the need to stay hopeful, because hopelessness is the enemy of justice. We talk about the need to stay brave, because change requires courage. We talk about the need to be faithful, because that's the way we overcome. And then in that fourth quarter, we have a water wall. and you see the water coming down, which is intended to kind of suggest something aspirational. And you leave the Monument Square, and then you enter into the Monument Park. And we have those amazing words. I reached out to Toni Morrison, who granted us permission to use these amazing words from Beloved, that powerful section where she talks about, they do not love your neck unnoosed. And so you've got to love it. They don't love your liver. They don't love your limbs. You've got to love it. And then she says, they don't love your heart, but you've got to love it because that's the prize. And with that exhortation, with that inspiration, you enter the Monument Park, where now the monuments are horizontal. They're positioned like tombs that
they look like coffins.
Yes, exactly.
And it doesn't hit you, because when you come in, they're just, as you described, they look like monuments. But then when you get into the park and they are on their sides, you realize these are coffins with the county name. Yes. And if there's a victim, the name, the date they were lynched, at the bottom is the county and the state again.
Yeah. Yes.
And this park is filled
That's
with
right.
these.
That's right.
How many of them are there, and what's the significance?
There's over 820, and we've put them there because they are there to remind us of the grief and the loss and the sorrow, but they are also there as a invitation, because we are calling on counties, each of these counties, to begin a process of truth-telling, a conversation. And we want them to come and claim their monument. And when communities come to us and present to us this commitment to erect the monument someplace in their community, we give it to them. So in 5 years, we hope to see many of those monuments gone. And that space will become a sort of report card on which communities have confronted this history, which communities have claimed their monument. Because you have to give people something to do. We don't want to just present them with all of this without a challenge, without a request. And our request is that we begin to localize this discourse that people will have when they come to Montgomery. When you come out of the Monument Park, that's where we have another sculpture by Dana King, guided by Justice, and it's three women who are walking, some burdened, some elderly, one woman pregnant, but they're walking nonetheless because they're determined to not ride the buses of Montgomery in 1955 as a commitment to greater freedom. It's the Montgomery bus boycott, the women who made it successful, made it possible. And that community where that memorial is at the heart of the African-American right. community that made the boycott successful. And then as you continue on, you see a final sculpture by Hank Willis Thomas, and it's just these figures with their arms raised, and it speaks to this moment of continuing menace, continuing threat for people of color. Raise Up is the final sculpture. And then you end with this amazing poem that we had commissioned from Elizabeth Alexander called Invocation, where she talks about both the weight of our past but the promise of our future. And it is a challenging place, but I hope visitors will find it to be an inspiring place, a place where you'll leave motivated to say never again.
The honesty of both the museum and the memorial harkened me back to the first time I visited the Holocaust Museum in Washington and just how powerful it was to be told history unvarnished and truthfully.
Yeah.
None of the gauzy, euphemistic language. Here's what happened, here's who did it, and here's what we can do to not have it happen again. When I went to Berlin and I went to the memorial there just beyond the Brandenburg Gate, and the name of the memorial is like the National Museum for the
Murder Jews.
Murder yeah, Jews of Europe. I mean, they hit you in right. the face. You cannot get around
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that was so powerful to be told history truthfully
yes.
and honestly.
Yes.
And even brutally
yes.
in order to get you to understand.
Yes. Yeah.
And so in seeing both the museum and the memorial, I think that's what sort of hit me, is that there's no sugarcoating here.
No.
If you come here,
You are, whether you want to or not, are going to be confronted and you will learn.
Yes, that's right. And I'm inspired by what they've done in Germany. I mean, you can't go 100 meters in Berlin without seeing markers or stones or monuments
right.
placed next to the homes of Jewish families. And what inspires me about that is that in Germany, people don't want to be thought of as Nazis and fascists for the rest of their lives, for generation after generation. They're trying to change the narrative. And because they talk about the Holocaust, because it's a country where you don't see Adolf Hitler statues, where there is no effort to glorify and romanticize that effort, that his era, I'm comfortable going there. In Rwanda, it's the same thing. The Genocide Museum in Rwanda, they have human skulls in there. And for a lot of people, they say, that's just crazy. But people so desperately want to express their grief, they feel the need to do that. And I think that it's a pathway to recovery. When we say we did something wrong, when we own up to our history of violence and abuse and tyranny and enslavement, when we do that, then the opportunity for redemption is born. That's how you get to recovery. That's how you get to restoration. That's how you get to reconciliation. It begins with telling the truth. In most faith traditions, you can't just show up and say, I've never done anything wrong, but I want salvation. You have to acknowledge this need, because it doesn't take, it doesn't resonate, it doesn't stick, it doesn't land. And in this country, we have developed a really bad habit of never saying, I'm sorry. And it leaves us incomplete as human beings, incomplete as a nation. Because apology isn't just something you're forced to do when you've made a mistake. Apology is how you grow strong, how you become more human. You show me two people who've been in love for 50 years, I'll show you two people who've learned how to apologize to one another when they hurt each other, when they've done something that didn't land the right way. That's how you build something stronger. And we haven't built a very strong relationship, a very healthy relationship to our history of racial inequality. And because of that, we continue to perpetuate racial inequality. And so I hope these museums become models for what other communities do to look more honestly at our past.
I want to take you back to a story you mentioned in this interview that I let slide by, but it gets to something that I've wondered in watching you do this work, this painful work. The courtroom story that you told of the judge.
Yeah.
Get out of no defendants right. at the table, and that you just have to right. suck it in and you have to smile for your client right. and everything. And it took me back to a story that you told. I believe it was in a TED Talk that you gave, where you were invited by a woman here, and Rosa Parks was coming, and she wanted to hear all about it. And then you said Rosa Parks told you that you would be tired, tired, tired by the work you were undertaking here at the Equal Justice Initiative. And then the woman who invited you said that you needed to be brave, brave, brave.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the strength to be brave and to not be tired when what you're doing is, it must just sap you of all kinds of energy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel really fortunate in some ways to be doing this work in Montgomery, because when you live in a place like Montgomery, when you work in a place like Montgomery, it's impossible to ignore that you're standing on the shoulders of so many people who have done so much more with so much less. You know, I sit in this room and I look out that window, and sometimes when I get really overwhelmed and really challenged, I'll look out the window and I'll think about the people who were trying to do what I'm trying to do 60 years ago. And what they had to frequently say is, my head is bloodied but not bowed. I've never had to say that. And as difficult as the task that we have to face, as hard as the work is, it's been made easier because enslaved people found a way to endure and survive. My great-grandparents were enslaved. My line is really short. My great-grandfather was born in the 1840s. My grandmother was born in the late 1880s. And so I was raised by this woman who would be in my ear talking about the experience of slavery. And she lived through terrorism. She fled Virginia, went to Philadelphia. After that terror, that violence forced her family to leave. My parents were humiliated every day by Jim Crow segregation, and yet found a way to teach me to love and not hate, to fight, to not accept that I'm less than somebody else because of my color. And when I think about the kind of courage it took to do that, when I think about the kind of commitment it took to do that, I just don't feel like I'm entitled. I don't even feel like I'm allowed to say, I'm tired, I can't do this, I can't do that. I feel like I have to do it because I'm being watched by the souls and spirits of the enslaved. I really do feel that. This street, it's so historic, right? Down three blocks from here is where enslaved people were brought. They will be paraded up this street. We're on the site of a former slave warehouse. All around here are spaces where people were lynched. Rosa Parks was pulled off that bus three blocks from here. Dr. King's church is this. I feel like I'm being watched by the souls and spirits of the enslaved, the lynched, the segregated. And with their sacrifice, with their struggle, with their heroism and their courage and their dignity, I can't actually stop. I can't not do what has to be done. And the beautiful thing is that when we actually do something that I hope is good, like this museum, that I hope is good, like this memorial, I don't just feel watched by those souls and spirits. I feel encouraged. I hear them maybe saying, okay, you keep doing that. That's a good thing.
Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, thank you so much. What an honor.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.